I'm Michael Brooks, and this is a special edition of the Majority Report with Sam Seder, introduced by me, Michael Brooks. Over the weekend, Justice Scalia died unexpectedly, and we all know that everybody knows we're taking this week off. But Sam recorded just this morning, Monday, February 15th, an interview with Ian Millhiser of Think Progress to discuss the implications of Justice Scalia's death, both on the court and decisions it's in the process of making now, as well as on the political dynamics in the Senate and in the presidential campaign. It's a very in-depth conversation. We're releasing two podcasts today, my conversation with Benjamin Dixon and Sam's conversation with Ian Millhiser on Justice Scalia's death and its implications. Listen to Sam and Ian right now.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Ian Millhiser. He, of course, is the author of Injustices and the senior justice editor at Think Progress. Ian, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be here. Thanks so much.
So pretty amazing turn of events. Obviously this weekend, the piece you wrote at Think Progress was the simply breathtaking consequences of Justice Scalia's death. And, there are really two sets of consequences, I guess. One is, of course, sort of the legal consequences on specific cases. And the other is the implications of the politics of the death of one of the, arguably at least one of the most well-known of the five conservative justices. Let's start, rather than sort of recounting Scalia's career, I think for our purposes today, let's talk about the immediate implications legally, because this, I think we've had you on earlier in the year, or perhaps at the beginning of this term, talking about some court cases which, from my perspective, were going to be very damaging for principles that I hold dear. Let's just start with the most recent, which is this stay on the EPA's ability to regulate coal production, or I should say coal plants. What happens in the case of a stay like that? I mean, where do we go forward on that?
Well, the bad news there is that one of Scalia's last acts on Earth may have been to doom it. So it takes five votes to put a stay in place. It takes five votes to lift the stay. And, there are still four justices who thought that stay, which blocked Obama's Clean Power Plan, his most ambitious effort to fight climate change, there's still four justices who think that stay shouldn't be there, but they need a fifth vote to lift it right now. So right now that stays in place. Where things get interesting is that the terms of the stay says that the stay remains in place until the lower court decides the case and until the court has the opportunity to dispose of a petition asking the court to review the case. So as I review that, once that petition is decided one way or another, even if they decide they want to take that case, it would take a new vote of five justices to continue the stay past that. So the D.C. Circuit, in the case front of the D.C. Circuit right now, there's a Democratic majority on the panel. It's likely that the lower court is going to uphold the rules. And where things get interesting is when the loser then applies to the court asking for the court to consider the case. it's unclear that the court's now going to have the votes to keep moving that stay forward, even if it decides to take the case.
Wow. Okay. That is fascinating. And I guess we should probably discuss some sort of the broad principles here. Now, let's start with the assumption that, I don't want to even assume that, but we know that the Republicans, and particularly folks like Ted Cruz, who sits on the Judiciary Committee, and certainly all the Republican candidates, and I think Mitch McConnell, I mean, I think to a man, and I do mean to a man, the Republicans have said we have very little intention, if any intention, of confirming a justice that President Obama nominates. And now it remains to be seen if they will actually follow through on those type of threats. They definitely don't want him to even nominate somebody. But regardless, we know there's going to be a period of time where we're talking about there's only being eight justices on the court. And in many of the contentious cases, we know this means a 4-4 split. So whether or not, let's just operate on whether we're talking about the next 6 months. I mean, certainly it's hard to imagine that cases in this term are going to go forward. But we could be talking about the next 6 months. We could be talking easily about the next really 13 months, right? Because even if a new president comes in and nominates somebody, it's going to be 13 months until someone's sitting on that court. So broadly speaking, what happens, before we go through a couple of specific more cases, what happens if it's a 4-4 tie? So let's take let's take the Friedrich case. You were on the program. We were talking about this. This was a case that had to do with agency fees paid to public sector unions. What happens in the Friedrich case, and use that as an example for what's going to happen broadly in a 4-4 situation?
Sure. So, I mean, first of all, it may not just be months. It could be years until this seat is filled. I mean, if a year from now, Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders is sitting in the White House and there's still a Republican Senate, I don't see how the facts on the ground are going to change. I mean, it's still going to be the case that the party that shut down the government in order to try to make some sort of last barbaric yelp against Obamacare will control the Senate. So it could be years until this seat is filled. The ordinary rule when there is an equally divided court is that the decision of the court below is affirmed, but that decision by the Supreme Court has no precedential value, so it doesn't control any future decision. I've heard some predictions that what the court will do in this case is schedule any case where there's a tie for rehearing, and they'll just have the rehearing after the new justice is seated whenever that happens. But in any event, the practical effect of the court not being able to decide a case is that normally the lower court will stand, and if they schedule a rehearing, it'll mean that the status quo will remain in place, which is generally going to be that the lower court's order stands. And it's going to matter a great deal to a lot of people which part of the country you live in. To take just one example, most circuits have said that a religious objector doesn't have the right to take away their employees' right to access birth control. Most courts have said that women can get birth control coverage plans regardless of whether or not their employer objects to birth control on religious grounds. But the Eighth Circuit, which covers Arkansas and Minnesota and Iowa and Nebraska, a whole band of states there in the middle, has said that a woman's boss can limit their right to birth control. So if you live in Arkansas, you're going to have less rights than you would if you lived in Pennsylvania.
Wow.
And that's going to be how it's going to look potentially on a whole lot of issues until that seat is filled.
So there's a sort of a favoring of the status quo in certain circumstances, I guess, right? I mean, insofar as if it's If it's 4-4 and it goes back to that last appellate court, chances are if that court would have held held the precedent. It's just those areas where there's not necessarily a precedent on point. Cases that theoretically the Supreme Court would take. All right, it's tough, I guess, when you start to parse it out in terms of specifics. But let's look at some of the specific cases that have come up in front of the Supreme Court or were anticipated to be argued in front of the court. And we were anticipating a ruling at the, in the June, I guess it would have been. So let's start with the with immigration. And I guess the United States versus Texas, that is a case about the expansion of DACA, right? This is basically the Dreamers Plus.
Right. So, yeah, this is a case, and there's two programs, DACA and DAPA. The policies that have been suspended by a lower court here would allow about 5 million Americans to temporarily remain in the United States and to work legally while they are here. This is the case that I think presents the most possibility for chaos. And the reason why is that the lower court in this case didn't just say that that these programs were illegal. It upheld a nationwide injunction that covers every state in the country. It's a very conservative court. It's not hard to imagine, though, some other litigant going to a different circuit and getting an order from that circuit saying that DAPA and the expanded DACA program are legal. In which case you'd have competing orders from two different courts of appeals. Ordinarily what happens in that case is that the Supreme Court steps in and resolves the conflict. But if the court is split 4-4, it's not at all clear that they're going to be willing to do that, that they're going to be able to do that. And so I don't know what the answer is. I mean, I literally don't know of any precedent for this where you have two competing court orders dealing with whether or not there should be a nationwide injunction against the United States of America and no possibility of Supreme Court review. I know of no precedent for that. And there could be considerable chaos because if another circuit upholds these programs, why isn't the Obama administration within its rights to say that it's going to enforce that's going to enforce its own policies, at least within the circuits that are the states that aren't covered by the one circuit that struck it down?
So it's conceivable that right now there is a immigration advocacy group that has found a potential plaintiff, I guess, and is headed to the D.C. Circuit Court and saying we want this stay overturned. And the D.C. Circuit Court says it's certainly within the authority of the president to take this type of action. And then we've got this sort of, I guess, showdown between the two courts.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that they could. You can't ask the D.C. Circuit to lift a stay that was put in place by the Fifth Circuit, but there are various ways I could think of where someone could just bring a lawsuit question, that raises the question of whether these programs are legal in a more liberal circuit, and eventually that case would make its way up, and if the judges in that case say yes, the programs are legal. Then it's not at all clear to me what happens. I mean, it's very unusual. You know, one thing that I think was very suspicious about the way the lower courts have handled this immigration case to begin with, it is not normal for a lower court to issue a nationwide injunction against the United States of America and refuse to stay it. That's something that almost never happens. There's Supreme Court cases saying that court should not do that. And so you have this very unusual case where a lower court issued a nationwide ruling saying that this thing cannot be implemented anywhere in the country. And now you have the possibility that the Supreme Court won't be able to review it, so you can have conflicting court orders. You have so many unusual and potentially unprecedented things piled on top of each other here. And, you know, I wish I knew the answer to what the courts are going to do. You know, I can't, I'm not even sure if I can look to precedent for this. I mean, wow. They might be, have to blaze a new trail.
Okay, let's move forward. You write in your piece that birth control will, or I should say, let's start with abortion. There's the whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt case. Yep. Briefly, what does that case involve, and what are the implications there?
So this is the single greatest threat to Roe v. Wade in a generation. The issue here, it deals with sham health laws. So the Supreme Court has said, you know, and sensibly so, that states can regulate abortion the same way they would regulate other health procedures. So, if you go to get a CAT scan, or you go to get an MRI, or you go to get a surgery, you know, there's regulations governing who's allowed to perform those procedures and how they're done safely. And the same thing is true about abortion. What happened here is Texas essentially passed a sham health law where they enacted a bunch of extraordinarily burdensome regulations targeting abortion clinics. If you look at them and you don't know much about health policy, they look like health regulations, but in reality, they don't actually do much at all to benefit anyone's health. They just impose a bunch of costs and burdens on the clinics, and they make it very difficult to find doctors who can legally perform abortions. So it's an attempt to essentially launder abortion ban, or at least very severe abortion restrictions, through the illusion of a health regulation. Prior to Scalia's death, there was a decent chance there were going to be 5 votes to strike this down, although I think that Justice Kennedy's vote is in play. Now that there's only 8 justices, there's a maximum of 4 votes. There's a maximum of 4 votes to uphold these policies, which means that, you know, Roe is safe. You know, for now, at least, we're not going to get an order from the Supreme Court saying that Roe v. Wade is either explicitly overruled or functionally overruled by allowing these kinds of sham laws. The bad news, though, for women is that the Fifth Circuit, which is the court below in this case, upheld the Texas law. And so if the Supreme Court splits 4-4, that means that Fifth Circuit order stands. And that means that if you're a woman in Texas or Mississippi and Louisiana, which are the other parts of the Fifth Circuit, your right to access an abortion is very limited. It is not nothing, but it is virtually nothing.
Wow. Wow. Okay. And so, the only chance that other people would be, other women would be implicated outside of that state would have to be a separate case going through their specific, circuit court that would end at its circuit court, I guess.
Go ahead.
No, I mean, I just wanted to confirm that I understood that dynamic.
Yeah, I mean, like, the issue if we get a 4-4 split in that abortion case is that a woman's right to choose is going to depend on what state they live in and what specifically which one of the 12 federal circuits they live within.
And there's a similar dynamic, it seems to me, as far as you tell, in terms of birth control. And you mentioned that in terms of their employer. We mentioned that earlier. Let's talk about Friedrichs. This is a case that we spoke about on the program that deals with a union's right when it has been charged with exclusively being the representative for all workers in a given environment. We're dealing with public sector here, or a specific workplace, that
right.
They have the ability not to mandate that all the workers join the union, but that at the very least, all the workers pay an agency fee to cover the cost of their negotiations on their behalf. So what did it look like before Scalia passed away, and what does it look like now?
Well, I mean, when news of Scalia's relief broke, every union, you know, the wind you felt was the sigh of relief emitted by every single union in the country, at least every single public sector union in the country. Because what looked like, you know, Friedrichs looked like it was going to be a train wreck for them, and now the anti-union side doesn't have the votes it needs. So what's at issue in Friedrichs? There's three principles that govern unions that are important to be aware of here. The first one is that when a workplace organizes, the union has a duty to bargain on behalf of everyone within the bargaining unit. So even if you don't join the union, you still get the higher wages and you still get the various benefits that the union negotiates for on your behalf. The second piece is that each individual worker has an absolute right not to join the union if they don't want to. And so at least in the public sector, that's true. And so if you don't feel like joining the union, you object to their political activities or whatever, don't join. You have that option. The third piece, and this is what Friedrichs is about, is that the union can negotiate for a clause in the contract, which says that even if you do not join the union, you still have to reimburse the union for your fair share of what it costs for the union to negotiate on your behalf. So like the cost of hiring lawyers and negotiators and all of that, you still have to contribute your fair share of what that costs the union. So the idea here is someone shouldn't be able to get something for nothing.
Right.
Friedrichs looked like it was going to say that at least for public sector unions, you can get something for nothing. It was going to say that it was illegal to have this clause in the contract saying that people who don't want to join the union still have to pay their fair share. Now there ain't five votes for that anymore. And the court below said that these fair share provisions are legal. So, you know, so long as this seat remains vacant, so long as we have the court that we have now and not a differently constituted court, public sector unions are safe.
Now, let me ask you this. One, what would have been the scenario if Scalia was alive, had joined with the other four conservatives to vote that to rule against these provisions and find them unconstitutional, I guess. How does what would have been the best possible scenario? Does that ever come back around? I mean, the chances of that being reversed by a Supreme Court that was composed of different people, right? I mean, you know, presumably Scalia and others, the entire nine, or they're all going to pass away at one point, right? The idea that would have been reversed, even if Scalia had passed away, say, hypothetically, a year from now, and we had President Bernie Clinton, let's say, and it had appointed a liberal to the court. The idea that case would have come back. How realistic is it that case comes back?
Yeah. So I mean, you're really hitting on the head the single biggest question that we need to ask in the event that Obama or Clinton or Sanders or any Democrat gets to fill Scalia's seat. Because if that seat is filled, Democrats will have a majority on the Supreme Court, and there's going to be a tension there. Because on the one hand, the court operates, you know, the principle of stare decisis. The court operates under the principle that precedents have a great deal of weight, because you don't want the law to shift wildly back and forth based on who won the last political battle to control the Supreme Court. And that's generally a good rule. On the other hand, there's a lot of decisions that the Roberts Court has handed down that has not been the least bit respectful of precedent. I mean, obviously, Friedrichs, if it had come down in the way that would have been bad for the unions, would have required them to overrule the precedent. Citizens United overruled a longstanding precedent. This is not a court that has been particularly respectful of stare decisis itself. And so the question that the Democratic appointees are going to have to ask themselves, if they suddenly control a majority, is to what extent are they going to say, look, I don't like that I didn't get my way in this past case, but we have to give respect to precedent. And to what extent do we have, are they going to say, well, you know, we're going to show you exactly as much respect for precedent as you showed us.
Right.
And I don't know what the answer is to that question. I think it's going to vary from case to case.
And so the fewer number of those cases they have to address in that regard, the better from the perspective of someone who shares our, I guess, political proclivities, as it were. So let me ask you one more question on the Friedrichs case. So is it conceivable, I mean, if this case came out of California, is it conceivable that that there could be another case that is winding through, let's say, I don't know, Texas, and that is basically arguing the same thing? By the time it gets to the Texas appellate level, circuit level, the Texas court, which is much more conservative, rules in the opposite way, where it basically says, right, these free agency, these free rider rules, they're not appropriate. You can't force somebody to pay for the services they're getting from the union. That would mean that in that circuit, if you're in a state within that circuit, then it's a different set of rules.
Yeah, I mean, that's always possible. I mean, one thing to bear in mind with Friedrichs is that there is currently a Supreme Court decision that's called Abood, which says that these fair share provisions are legal.
Okay.
So, you know, in order for a lower court to do what the plaintiffs were asking for at Friedrichs, they would have to ignore a binding precedent of the Supreme Court of the United States. That said, the way that binding precedents of the Supreme Court of the United States are typically enforced is that if a lower court judge goes rogue, the Supreme Court can reverse you. And, you know, it is entirely possible, if you have a very deeply ideologically conservative judge, like many of the judges on the Fifth Circuit are, and they're staring at a Supreme Court that no longer has the power to reverse them on a lot of issues because it's split 4-4, you know, am I certain that there aren't panels? I think there are definitely panels that could be assembled on the Fifth Circuit that would say, you know what, I'm going to, you know, I think this is the right thing, and I think that the Abood has been undermined, and so I don't think it's good law anymore. And, you know, that is the sort of thing that should be reversed, but there's no guarantee that it will be reversed.
Wow. And so we should say now, I mean, that in hindsight, certainly, and I think we had already sort of come to this realization, but even more so now, that semi-nuke option of insisting that the Senate does not have the power, or the Senate minority does not have the power to filibuster all judicial appointments below the Supreme Court, was a very wise move, because we now have a federal judiciary that is at its full complement. And in the most part, at least most of these circuits, right, will maintain precedent in a situation like that. Most of those circuits will uphold an Abood. Most of those circuits will uphold a Roe v. Wade. And that is, in hindsight, that move looks even more important.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say two things. I mean, one is that right now, 9 of 13 circuits have a majority of Democratic appointees. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're a majority Democrat or majority liberal, because there's a lot of compromises that get made. And so on the 11th Circuit in particular, which is Florida, Georgia, and Alabama, there are a lot of nominees who are confirmed to that court who are Democratic appointees but are very, very conservative because compromises were made. But there are 9 circuits that have majority Democrats. That means most people in the country, if it comes down to what your circuit says, you're more likely than not going to get a ruling that aligns with what left of center judges think. Right. There are a number of caveats to that, though. One is that most decisions by courts of appeals are decided by 3-judge panels. It can matter a great deal what random selection of 3 judges the court's computer happens to pick for your case. And then the other thing that I would say is that it matters a great deal what kind of Republicans you get if you do get a conservative panel, because, I don't want to impugn the integrity of Republican judges too much. I think most Republican judges faced with a situation where Abood is the law of the land and there's a case that's trying to undermine unions, most of them would say, look, I don't like Abood, but my job is to obey binding precedent, and I'm going to obey this binding precedent. I think most Republican judges would do the right thing there.
Right.
But I do think that there are many on the courts of appeals, and particularly in the Fifth Circuit, who are less principled than that.
And who would take advantage of this situation? Well, all right. Well, let me just quickly, because I've held you too long. But let me just quickly, the week or two goes on, I don't imagine we're going to see a nominee within a week or two. Though I guess it's conceivable, but give us a couple of names so that people, if they want to do a little research on themselves, to keep an eye on. One of the names that I've heard over and over again already is Judge Srinivasan.
Srinivasan, I think is how you pronounce
okay,
his
thank
name.
You. Srinivasan. Yeah, he's one judge. Go ahead.
Yeah, Sri is the name that's getting thrown around a lot. I mean, I've known Sri for a few years. He's an extraordinarily nice guy. I really like Sri. He's also a brilliant, brilliant litigator who's probably one of the best Supreme Court litigators in the country before he became a judge. But his record is not the record of a strong liberal. He clerked for J. Harvey Wilkinson, who was a Reagan appointee on the Fourth Circuit, and then for Sandra Day O'Connor, who was also a Reagan appointee on the Supreme Court. He spent his career bouncing back and forth between government service and corporate law firm O'Melveny & Myers. So if you look at his resume, I think that he's a Democrat. I think that he's probably going to be, to the left of Scalia. But he's the sort of nominee that a Democratic president would nominate if they were looking to extend an olive branch. When Sri was up for confirmation to his job, his current job as a court of appeals judge, he was confirmed 97-0.
Wow.
So he is the olive branch nominee, and it's going to be extraordinary. I mean, if the Republicans carry out their threat not to confirm anyone, including Sri, because it's really hard to imagine a more conciliatory move that Obama could make than nominating someone like Sri.
That's fascinating. And so he is, and then we have, I guess there are more liberal. I mean, it seems to me there's just the White House has to make a decision as to there's so many factors here, right? It's one, do they think anybody could get confirmed? Two, if they think nobody can get confirmed, what is the order in which they offer people up? And three, those people who are getting nominated have to know that this is going, it could very well go nowhere. Do you burn a nominee? In other words, let's say there's some other ones. I don't know. Some other names I've heard have been Denny Chin, who is on the appeals for the Second Circuit, the appeals court of the Second Circuit. I've heard the name Edith Ramirez. She is at the Federal Trade Commission. I've heard the name Tino Cuellar, who is a judge on the, I think, the California Supreme Court.
There's a huge list of names. I mean, I could rattle names off, you know, Paul Watford, Jane Kelly, Pam Harris, Pam Carlin, Goodwin Liu, you mentioned Tino. I could keep rattling names off. There's a huge list of names. One thing that, you know, the president is very fortunate is that there is a fairly substantial bench of sitting judges, both on the courts, the federal courts of appeals, and Governor Jerry Brown has done a spectacular job of naming three young, brilliant people to the California Supreme Court. So there's three people there that he could pick. So there's a lot of names, and I could keep rattling off names. I think what the Obama administration wants to do here is two things. You know, they want to make sure that if Republicans carry out their threat to block everyone, that they take maximal damage for doing so. And that means that Obama needs to make sure that he picks someone who's an extraordinary nominee that everyone looks at and goes, yeah, of course that person qualified to be on the Supreme Court. It also means that, you know, I'm sure Obama's going to be thinking in terms of who are the groups that he wants to be upset. And so a lot of people have speculated he'd pick an African-American nominee. That could be Paul Watford on the Ninth Circuit. That could be Leandra Kruger on the California Supreme Court. Tommy Goldstein at SCOTUS Blog said today it could be Attorney General Loretta Lynch. So if you want the black nominee, there are plenty of people out there. So other people are speculating he might want a woman, he might want a Latina, and he has choices there as well. But whoever he picks, I think that what is going on is, first of all, it has to be someone truly extraordinary so that no one can think that he's just playing politics here. And then the second thing is he's probably thinking in terms of, okay, if they're going to carry out this threat, how do I make them look like jerks?
All right. So let me ask you this. If just say that he picks, I don't know. I'm just pulling one of those names. Tino Cuellar. Let's say he offers up that nominee. The Senate Judiciary Committee goes through, and how they present, right, will be one of the issues, right? They could say, like, well, we're going to pretend like we're going to look at your nominee, your qualifications, and then ultimately we'll say no. Or they could just show up at the first meeting and say, we don't care if this is, you've somehow reanimated Robert Bork. We're just anybody that you send, we're just not going to do. So now there's two questions for you. One is, does Tino Cuellar come back if he gets rejected or he quits the nomination process or however that comes to an end? Does he come back? Could he come back in a year when the Democrats control the Senate? Or is that basically it? You get one bite at the apple, no matter what the circumstances are, you're done. And the second question, which sort of dovetails with that, is how does it end in this situation? Or can we possibly know? In other words, could President Obama theoretically nominate three people before November?
Going to the first question, I think that if he puts someone up, that person's shot down, then whether that person's still a viable nominee in the future depends on the circumstances of how they went down. So if Obama nominates Justice Cuellar and it turns out that Cuellar has a tax problem in his history, or, you know, who knows, that, like, you know, that he committed some terrible crime, or that he wrote some opinion that everyone looks at and says, that's a monstrous opinion. How could you then, like, that was a mistake in vetting, and that'll come out, and he's probably toast in the future. But if he's shot down because Republicans are just being jerks and refuse to give everyone a fair hearing, then I don't see any reason why he'd be tainted by the fact that he was unfairly treated by a process where the outcome was preordained.
Okay. And so, and let me ask you this. Do you anticipate we'll have one nominee, or do you anticipate that the process will play out in such a way that we could have multiple nominees who are shut down? I mean, or is there any way to know? And is either scenario possible?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible of multiple nominees. I mean, there's two things to bear in mind. I mean, one is that the Republicans in the Senate are probably going to slow walk the process as much as they possibly can. So, whoever the nominee is, there'll be a series of increasingly burdensome requests for information. They'll delay the hearing as much as they can. They'll delay the vote as much as they can. And so they're going to try to slow walk it. And the other thing to keep in mind is that coming up with a nominee is itself an extraordinarily burdensome process for the White House. Right. There's a lot of vetting. There's a lot of interviews. If you're the nominee, you have to ask yourself, do I want to get dragged through the mud when there probably isn't a prize waiting at the end for me? So it's possible that, the combination of the Republicans dragging out and just the human factor of, if you're the White House counsel and there's 3 months left in Obama's term, do you want to devote all of your staff's time to coming up with a new nominee who's not getting confirmed, or do you want to do something else?
Right.
And so there are those human factors there. That said, I think that Obama could, if he decides there's a particular message he wants to send, if you agree with the analyst who said that he's going to put up a exceptionally qualified African-American nominee so that he can show how poorly these nominees are being treated to black voters, then he could put up Paul Watford, and then he could put up Loretta Lynch, then he could put up Justice Kruger from the California Supreme Court. Then he could put up Danielle Gray, who's a very, very excellent African American attorney who used to work in the White House. And I you keep playing this game. So he doesn't lack well qualified nominees to sit on the Supreme Court.
Right.
It's just going to come down to how much work people want to put into what's essentially a political game.
Ian Millhiser, Think Progress, the Justice reporter over there. I've butchered your credentials, but also author of Injustices, which we will link to at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate
According
it.
According to the program, you have drawn performance slot number
you.
Three.
Bye-bye.
We're going last? Isn't that bad?
All right, folks. Bear with me here. I hit some button that caused a problem there. So, ladies and gentlemen, that is this. I wanted to just get on and cover this, a huge happening. And of course, there's a whole nother set of political implications of what it's going to mean for the Republican race, what it's going to mean for the Democratic race. And those are conversations that we're going to have and can have a week from now when we return. But, just contemplate now how the dynamics of the race, and how, frankly, I would be surprised if electability for both parties doesn't become more of an issue. I mean, it's always there in the background, but I would imagine something like this moves it to the foreground. Now, that doesn't necessarily change the arguments of any given candidate's electability, but I suspect it's going to focus the mind of voters on that question as the implications of this election become a little bit clearer and a little bit more real. And it's certainly so, you know, at this juncture for the right, because they stand to lose a voice on the Supreme Court, or I should say they have. The question is will that fifth justice be retained as a conservative? Obviously, not if a Democratic president has any say in the matter. So it's just a fascinating turn of events. I have got to go back and resume my vacation so that my family does not get even more angry with me. But I hope you're all doing well, and thanks for listening. Now we'll go back to Michael, or if not, then I don't know how we're going to play this. Let's put it this way. I don't know if we're going to put this out as a separate show and hold back on one of the shows that we had planned or what. But nevertheless, thanks for listening, and more to come. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. My pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somewhere I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. Shifted it.